This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. While the COVID-19 outbreak has led to some heavy-handed approaches to public health, many of us may also feel the effects of the economy's invisible hand. The domino effect was seen yesterday when the stock market had its biggest single-day loss since 2008 due to concerns over the virus and an oil price war. Last week, the Federal Reserve did one of the few things it can do to bolster the economy. It lowered interest rates. Lake Effect's Julian Haida spoke with a local economist to learn about what might be next.
Stephen Cole, economist at Marquette University, thank you for joining Lake Effect.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
So first things first, I wanted to ask, before we get to some more of the recent news, about the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates last week, supposedly in response to the coronavirus outbreak. First, get us up to speed about what interest rates are and why the Federal Reserve sets them.
Mm-hmm. So usually when people see interest rates, you know, maybe front page of a newspaper, the interest rate that they usually talk about with the Federal Reserve is called the federal funds rate. And technically that thing is the rate that banks charge each other for overnight loans. Now, ultimately this rate is set by market forces, but the Federal Reserve has a great deal of influence over this rate. And what's really interesting about this is that a lot of other costs of borrowing rates are tied to this. So this federal funds rate, these rates that you see tied to the Federal Reserve, this really serves as a benchmark for other costs of borrowing. So like your 30-year home fixed mortgage rates, the prime rate, other costs of borrowing are usually tied to this. So the Fed, when they usually want to try to maybe stimulate the economy, they usually try to lower just the benchmark rate because all other costs of borrowing rates tend to go down with it. And then if they want to do the reverse, maybe slow down the economy, they tend to raise rates.
So for example, if I were to buy a car because I see that the interest rates are low, I'd be more likely to buy a new car, which comes right off the assembly line that creates jobs, right? Whereas if the interest rates were higher, it might cost me more to buy a new car, meaning that I might not be as prone to do so.
That's correct. That's correct. And usually, especially out of the most recent recession of 08 or 09, when you hear about 0% APR financing, those type of things, that's due to Fed lowering its benchmark rate really low. And then in tandem, like you said, your car loan, for instance, that rate will come down low. And that is to encourage, you know, consumers to take out a loan to maybe spread the economy or even businesses to take out loans to build new factories or buildings and those type of things.
And as such, then, more money is in circulation. So the inverse effect is when interest rates are low, more people borrow, meaning that there's a chance of higher inflation.
Perhaps, yeah. So that's really what you see in the textbooks and econ. You know, interest rates are low. If there's more money in the economy, usually in the long run, you tend to see more inflation. And recently, though, in the past 10 or so years, we have seen really low interest rates with the big money supply, but not as much inflation. So it's really interesting time now. We have low interest rates, somewhat low inflation with a big money supply as well.
Sure. So when the Fed decided to lower their interest rates by 0.5%, now it's around like 1-ish%. Mm-hmm. That's really low. After the financial recession of 2008, you mentioned, you know, the starting point there was around 5%. And, you know, there was a huge recession people hear about in the 70s where the interest rates before that were, you know, close to 30%. So, you know, when you hit that kind of 1% mark that we're at right now, we have more or less full employment in this country. Stock markets until a few weeks ago are doing pretty well. How much lower can you go if you're the Federal Reserve?
Exactly. And that's one of the big fears too. So historically, the Fed has the normal that maybe the average interest rate has been, you know, higher than what it is now. And, you know, usually during recessions, they lower this interest rate and that tends to boost the economy. But what was really, really interesting about the most recent recession is it was the most significant recession since the Great Depression. So the Fed, they drop interest rates essentially to zero and can't go any lower than that. So essentially, when it drops to zeros, they lost a lot of their stimulative power from their conventional tool. And now with interest rates, and since the most recent recession, interest rates have gradually gone up. But now, like you just alluded to last week, they dropped interest rates and the target range is between 1% and 1.25%. So one of the fears is, you know, if some big event happens, maybe adverse event happens that affects the economy, Maybe the Fed might not have as much what we call conventional ammo to lower interest rates because they only can lower it by only so much.
So what are some of the alternatives? For example, I was reading that there's an internal memo at J.P. Morgan Chase just a couple of days ago. They're saying there's a 90% chance of a recession in our economy. Now, I don't know if you want to take that with a grain of salt, if, as, you know, as some have said, it's alarmism. But I'm curious, if there were a recession, as some people are saying, and we can't lower interest rates much lower than they are, what are some of the alternatives to, for example, stimulating the economy?
Well, first say that we've been in a record-long expansion in the U.S. over 10 years, and all indicators before the kind of the coronavirus outbreak, a lot of indicators have said that we're still humming along, good GDP growth, relatively close inflation to our targets, but if another recession hits and like we lose the stimulated power from lowering interest rates if they hit the zero lower bound, a couple other alternatives that the Fed has used. One is large-scale asset purchases, or sometimes referred to as quantitative easing, where they purchase not just short-term government bonds but more long-term government bonds to try to influence the longer-term interest rates. And then another one, too, is what we call forward guidance, where they give guidance on the future path of policy, maybe where interest rates are going to be in the future, for how long, or under what conditions will interest rates remain low. And that can have a lot of stimulated effects because if businesses think that interest rates may be low, for instance, into the future, that can play into their decisions about what to do right now. So there's a couple other tools that they've experimented with. And right now, too, they've in the past year or so, they've been under this monetary policy review, say that, okay, we have this conventional tool, change the federal funds rate, but what other tools should we add to our package? So it's an ongoing process right now with some other tools they can use to fight off any recessions.
Sure. Now, I'm curious, you mentioned quantitative easing, issuing bonds as a way of kind of helping the economy, or kind of different ways of issuing bonds. I'm pretty new to Milwaukee. I drive to work. I take I-43, and I see this massive billboard that I haven't seen in previous trips to Milwaukee. It was put up last fall, the national debt, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that debt, supposedly, or kind of traditionally is thought of as coming from bonds and stuff like that. It's a little more complicated as far as I understand. But what do you see with regards to the state of our economy and this kind of really kind of scary looking billboard that without much context, it's at the side of the highway.
Yeah. So I think it's definitely important for citizens to understand, the number that the national debt is at right now. And I believe it end of 2019 fiscal year, I think it's about 79% of GDP. And that's for the largest since about World War II. And also too, end of, I think, fiscal year 2019, then annual budget deficit was about 4.5% GDP, and historically it's been about 3%. And this is all, like you alluded to earlier, with essentially full employment. So that's kind of concerning for a couple reasons. Is if we keep having to pay interest on all this debt that we have to service, that could potentially lead to maybe we have to allocate more funds to pay interest, whereas maybe those funds could be used for, construction or education or defense or whatever. And then also, too, back to the recession, since we've already borrowed a lot, if another recession hits, maybe there might not be as much political appetite to pass, more stimulus plans. There's really no certain number that the economy is going to be drastically affected. But it seems right now that, people are willing to lend to us and we're not too much crowding out private investment, but it is definitely a big number, alarming number to be
sure
to notice.
Well, I mean, if in the case of a recession, if there isn't so much in a tax base, and this is, of course, the national debt. This is about government spending. This isn't necessarily about the state of our economy. But if there isn't as much of a tax base given a recession, then the government needs to think of other ways, whether that be issuing bonds to keep government services alive and to keep a certain amount of people employed and money in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, if a next recession happens, definitely they would have to. Historically, what they usually do, try to increase government spending or even decrease taxes. So like you said, want to increase government spending, get more people jobs too. So that's like part of the fiscal side. And then also, the monetary policy side.
It's also pretty different from 2008, which was, people cite the bailout as being a pretty big driving factor. But that was the that was the private sector that really kind of got the bailout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since the most recent recession, a lot of it dealt with, you know, the financial markets. And yeah, like you alluded to, like a lot of money directed towards the financial markets to kind of keep it on life support, at least save it so the economy doesn't, you know, teeter even further.
I do want to ask you the $10 million question.
Though. Yes, yes, yes.
A lot of people tout the stock market. I mean, if you would have asked me a few months ago, I think if you have asked anybody a few months ago whether the stock market's doing well, the stock market was doing well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet people are talking about you know, stagnant wage growth for years and years and years. I mean, slight wage growth with higher employment as of the last few years. But mm-hmm. what can we learn about the economy from looking at the stock market? Is the health of an economy dependent on the stock market? This is, I mean, every economist has been asked this question, but I want to ask you, Marquette University professor,
yes,
Stephen
yeah,
Cole.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, so definitely the stock market is one big indicator you should look at, you know, determine the health of the economy. We have a lot of public companies on our stock market, as well as, you know, credit is really what we call like the lifeblood of our economy. And, you know, in the markets, that's where, you know, businesses get their loans and everything. So, you know, it's definitely part, one of the big key indicators you want to look at if you want to look at the health of the economy. But, you know, you should also look at it in tandem with, you know, how's GDP doing? How's inflation doing? And how's the labor markets doing? Alluded to slow wage growth. Yeah, definitely that was a concern about, okay, our economy's picking up out of the recent recession, unemployment's going down, but we haven't seen really wages rise. I'd say like very recently wages has started to pick up more, but overall in the past 10 years, somewhat slower. So definitely stock market is one key indicator, but it should be looked at in tandem with other big indicators, macro indicators.
Sure. Now changing gears a little bit mm-hmm. to the other big elephant in the room with regards to the economy, oil prices. So just yesterday we saw that Saudi Arabia was engaging with Russia on lowering oil prices. Russia is a major oil supplier, so is the United States. But Saudi Arabia, as the kind of head of OPEC, the organization that leads a lot of other oil-producing countries, in driving the price of oil down. Now, they're saying this is related to keeping themselves afloat with regards to the coronavirus concerns. But at the same time, their cost of extracting oil and refining oil is much lower than for other countries. So what do you think this will have with regards to an effect on the economy here in the United States and more locally?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, with this kind of decrease in the oil prices, there could be, you know, a couple effects. You know, one, lower prices, you know, tend to help, you know, consumers when they purchase gas at the pump. So that could be a big driver too. Maybe more adverse effects would be, you know, since we're all in this kind of interconnected global economy, lower prices probably would hurt more countries that are more dependent on oil exports. So if those prices tend to fall, maybe that might hurt U.S. production who produce oil. So right now, yeah, they could have different effects. The question would be which one tends to outweigh the other. You know, will lower prices help consumers more, or would it help?
And might stimulate
hurt
the economy
exactly
where the interest rate can't.
Yeah, or, you know, lower prices hurt production in the U.S. or even abroad too, and that might come back to hurt us too. So,
sure. Now, I know scholars such as you don't always like to speculate, but just for sake of what people might be able to look out for. I'm wondering, you know, if, for example, this standoff between Russia and Saudi Arabia lasts a little bit longer, oil prices will remain relatively low. That would assume that other, for lack of a better word, more friendly oil producers to the U.S., so the U.S. oil industry, Canada, our neighbor, huge oil exporter, they're operating at a loss. So after a few months or a few years of operating at a loss where they're selling oil at prices that are lower than it costs for them to produce that oil, because nobody can beat Saudi Arabia's overhead, mm-hmm. low overhead, mm-hmm. What would happen in that case? I mean, on the one hand, you could stimulate the economy because oil is cheap. But on the other hand, you have these huge oil companies that will be looking towards more shale extraction, which would presumably lower the price domestically as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you you know, tend to see low oil prices and prices below, you know, firms' break-even points, then, you know, over the medium long term, you probably expect that maybe some companies might just cut back because they're obviously that wouldn't make sense to be in business. So it could further put pressure, upper pressure on prices too. But in terms of the U.S., you know, relative to maybe 20, 30 years ago, you know, since we have this big, you know, shale production, a lot of more supply of oil out there. So probably, you know, oil, the price of oil will remain probably relatively on the lower side, you know, compared to maybe historical norms. But yeah, it's just hard to see. And you never know, too, there's a geopolitical aspect to all this, too. So you never know if Russia and Saudi Arabia would, you know, come to an agreement or something like that, too, to maybe stabilize the price of oil. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, oil changes so quickly, unlike other kind of economic markers.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I want to ask one more question. A lot of people were talking about in 2016 about how the election was really about the economy, about the forgotten man. So, you know, not to wade too much into the politics, but with regards to policy, how much do you think economics will play into this year's electoral cycle?
Yeah, even though we've been in a decades-long expansion, or over a decades-long expansion, excuse me, and low unemployment, you know, some of the benefits of this expansion have maybe not been as even as possible. So I think definitely voters look at, you know, how maybe a presidential candidate will affect jobs, will affect other needs, other services that they might need too. So I think that will definitely continue to play a big role in the upcoming election.
Sure, especially if the kind of volatility we've been seeing continues.
You see too that, you know, a lot of sometimes what drives the economy are, you know, people's perceptions about, you know, what's going to happen to the economy in the near future, consumer sentiment, for instance. You know, people think that economy is going to do well in the future. You know, that tends to keep the economy afloat. But if people are more pessimistic about things, then that can drive down the economy too. So that's another important indicator to keep track of when you look at, you know, people's perceptions about the economy.
Right. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Stephen Cole is a professor of economics at Marquette University. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Stephen Cole, assistant professor of economics at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida.